Welcome to episode 225 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have as our featured guest the great American playwright Martina Mayoc. She is right now working on a production of one of her pieces called Cost of Living that is going to open in June at the Manhattan Theater Club off Broadway. And we talk about that production. We talk about some themes involved, including abundance and need, about able-bodied and disabled people and actors. We also talk about other pieces she's written and some she's working on for the future, as well as some TV and movie aspirations. And also I ask her about what if Mike Pence came to one of her shows. Great conversation with Martina Mayoc. We also, that's my dinner here in the background. We also have another essay by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, titled University of the Night. We have an EW essay by yours truly called Republicans Are Awful. And we have a poem titled Beloved. All of this, of course, is intertwined, enmeshed within several great tunes. It's nice to have you with you, all of our troubadours and raconteurs across this great planet of ours. Let's get to it. Episode 225 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Republicans are awful. Lollygagging, flatulent, mud-smackers, wearing high-priced suits, yet empty as a Grand Canyon. Swift to please their masters of political ego and nasty, nasty small minds and even smaller hearts. As the orange, as an orangutan with the dye job comb over, smiles eternally stupid into the wall-to-wall abyss of flashbulbs and microphones, seeking acceptance, food for his hubris, so that he might fill the void he has perhaps intrinsic, perhaps because his mother or father didn't know how to love him. Perhaps he just enjoys being loathsome and stupid, incoherent and insensitive to his fellow man and woman. The House seeks to please and make deals with this absurd force of nature gone bad. His cabinet, a team of adept pricks and mediocre narcissists, coming of age in their extraordinary privilege. As we witness, either in denial or in furious despair. And in the meantime, these camouflaged creeps take away provisions for our health care, protections for our natural environment. They believe compassion should exist without comfort, as only they are worthy of it. And the wealth and access of this land they believe should be theirs, only theirs. The rest of us should champion the injustice and cruelty as the American way, and weirdly so, too many do. Republicans are awful.
When you just can't express yourself, and it's hard to trust enough to undress yourself, to stand exposed and naked in a world full of hatred, where the sick thoughts of mankind control all the sacred. I pause, take a step back, record all the setbacks, fast forward towards the stars and the jetpack. My feet might fail me, my heart might ail me, the synagogues of Satan might accuse or jail me. I get something to say. Yesterday's gone, tomorrow's on the way. That name on that birth certificate, that in the real me, that in the real me, the lies can't conceal me. The sunrise and the moon tides and the sky is gonna reveal me. My brain pours water on my dirt to heal me. I got something to say. Oh, yesterday's gone, tomorrow's on the way. The message grab a hold to every ears that get whispered in. The waters and the bayous of New Orleans still glistening. Yeah. The universe is listening, be careful what you're saying it. My grandma told me every bet an eagle make, he lay in it. I got something to say. Oh, yesterday is gone, tomorrow's on the way. The church you go to pray in it, the work is on the outside, staring out the windows. It's for love songs and house flies. I got something to say. Oh, yesterday is gone.
Hello? Martina Majok, is that you?
Hello. It is. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, no. This is normal stuff. It's a pleasure to have you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. And sorry for the technical difficulties. Were you playing the, like, da-da-da-da-da-da song, like what we were waiting for?
Yeah, yeah. That's the my go-to music. Yeah. How'd you know?
Yeah, you know, I figured.
So how's everything going? We talked to you about a year ago.
Yeah.
And
It's good.
Yeah, it seems to be. I mean, you're working on a production now, and I want to give people some background before we get into our conversation. We're talking to one of the premier playwrights in New York City, thus the nation, thus I would venture to say the world, really. And
I'll take that.
You should. You deserve it. A very young artist, but
I'll take that too.
Yeah, but seasoned nonetheless. Many, many awards, much experience in the field of theater. So I'm going to read a couple things. There's so much here, but let's see. Where shall I start? Her plays have been performed and developed at the O'Neill Theater Center, Steppenwolf Theater Company, Williamstown Theater Festival, Manhattan Theater Club, Actors Theater of Louisville, Rattlestick Playwrights Theater, Woman's Project Theater, Ensemble Studio Theater, Roundhouse Theater, and the list. I mean, it just goes on. The Labyrinth Theater Company, John F. Kennedy Center, Dorset Theater Festival, and there's a bunch of awards as well. The Charles MacArthur Award for Outstanding Original New Player Musical, a.k.a. the Helen Hayes Awards. That one stands out to me, but, I mean, there's so many very impressive awards. And as I mentioned, I mean, the list goes on. You can go online and just do a Google, and you'll see. Very impressive. And also
thanks for this nice morning compliments.
It helps with the rest of the day, I suppose.
Yes.
So Cost of Living is the latest piece. Last year, you debuted it at the Williamstown Theater Festival, and that's where you met my colleague, Dr.
Yeah.
Michael Pavese, and that's how we got you on the show. And now you're going to be staging it on the stage of the Manhattan Theater Club, which is off-Broadway, and that's happening May 16th, previews start, and then opening night June 7th, right?
Right. Yeah.
So tell us how the rehearsals and such are going for Cost of Living.
Yeah, it's great. It's fun. It's strange to work on a play with so much time in the middle, because you start to work on other shows, you start to write other plays, and then it's like having to switch gears to go back to a different story from a different part of your life too, which is interesting, because you were coming at it with a different lens. So the first production feels raw because you're still, you still might be going through some of the things that you were dealing with when you were writing it. And then now there's just this interesting kind of perspective on it. And so I think that makes it you can access it in a kind of a more universal way and rewrite it towards that. So things that I might not have caught or being able to refine that I can do now with a little bit of perspective. And the cast is great, and we're having a fun time, and it's good. Yeah, we're having a lot of fun.
I bet you there is a lot of fun going on. You have some talented folks involved. You have the Obie Award winner, Jo Bonney.
Yeah, she's great.
Directing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is that fun?
Yeah, she did the first one too, so it's been nice to get back to work with her. Yeah.
And I know there are several themes. I don't know how much you want to share with our listeners, but I know one thing that you focus on is a contrast between abundance and need. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I started writing the play when I had just moved to New York, and that was a year where I had 13 apartments and bed bugs.
13 apartments in 1 year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Not fun. We moved to, my husband and I got married in a backyard in the woods, and my mom made my dress, and we made a bunch of Polish food, and that was welcome to our wedding, because neither of us come from money, which that's just what it is. And we moved to New York. I think we had $2,000 between the two of us, and we didn't have enough to have a security deposit or anything really. We had no furniture. We just finished grad school. And so all we could do was sublet. Our lease was up in New Haven where we went to grad school. And then we decided to move to the closest major city, close to Connecticut, which is New York. And we couldn't afford a brokerage fee or security deposit, so we just sublet and thought, if we work a lot in New York, certainly won't be able to save some money, which is not necessarily true. And we thought that within 2 months we'd have enough money, and we didn't, so we had to sublet again. And in that sublet, we got bed bugs. The owners they knew they had, it was terrible. I had PTSD from, every time I talk about it, I start to get itchy, it's really gross. Now I'm the cleanest person in New York City because I have disinfected everything.
I can make you feel better. I have a bunch of kids, and this winter we had lice go through the house from school.
Oh man.
That was horrifying.
No.
Horrifying. It took about 4 months, but yeah, I feel it.
Yeah, it just becomes that's all you're dealing with. I mean, we had lost a lot of our stuff. The owners actually, they knew that they had them, which was just awful. They knew that they had them, they left, and they didn't want to return our money. I ended up having to ask one of my friends who was an actor, but then he went to law school. But he didn't pass the bar. I was like, can you just pretend to be a lawyer and call them and just scare them into giving us back our money? And it worked. And so they gave us back our money. But we lost so much of our belongings and time and just the money and all that stuff. So it was lots of problems that had to do with the fact of us not having money. And we never quite got back on our feet. And so during that year, which is my first year in New York, I wasn't able to really write many plays. I didn't have much time to devote to that. It was survival. But I wrote little things here and there, and they had to do with, economic difficulties and things like that. And it was always been a part of my life, but not, it was just coming back after grad school.
And you were at Yale studying theater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was totally funded. I wasn't gonna that was also another thing, is I couldn't go to school without fellowships or scholarships and things like that. So part of going to school of drama was they had health insurance. They had health insurance and gave you a stipend. So I was like, I'll go there. Sounds great. During that long year, I was part of a theater, a writing group. I just joined it so that I could make sure that I had some kind of connection to this world, even though I was, dealing with all this other stuff. And they did a 10-minute play festival. The focus of it was jobs. That was the theme that they wanted me to write a short, a 10-minute play about. So I thought, and I had just lost my job. I was cocktail waitressing at the time. And I was like, what am I going to write about? Do I write about being unemployed? And somebody asked me, well, what's your most memorable job? And I started writing about when I worked as a caregiver for a man with cerebral palsy when I was still in Chicago. And the story became about a person of a lower class meeting a person with of a higher class, but that their differences, in addition to the money they come from, is their ability. One is able-bodied and one is, and the other is disabled. And so it kind of started from there. And I realized that during that year, every sort of short play or short piece I was working on, because I couldn't really focus on a larger piece, every short piece had to do with the kind of have and have nots and grief and grief for your own dreams, grief for people. And I realized some of the short plays were talking to each other, and so then I put them together for A Cost of Living. I swear it's funnier than I'm making it sound.
No, it's compelling. It's compelling. And you have another work, I think, is what got you the Charles MacArthur Award, right?
Oh, no, that's Ironbound.
That was right, exactly. That's the other one,
yeah,
I'm thinking.
Ironbound. Yeah, yeah. So that's the story of, largely based on my mom, a story of a Polish immigrant who's dealing with, yeah. But it's true, it is a kind of have-not. It's just that all of the people in that one, it's all the people that are of a lower class instead of comparing them.
So it's about abundance and need, that one, more so, or mm-hmm. as well as this yeah. cost of living. Cost of living also has the disabled and able-bodied persons as a theme. And mm-hmm. and the actors that mm-hmm. are playing the disabled characters, is it hard for them? Are they disabled actors?
They are, yeah. Yeah, that was a really important thing for me, was to have disabled actors in the role. It's one of the first things I put into the script, because for so long people have decided to not go into that community, because there are artists in that community. There are actors, there are writers, you know, that are eager to be seen and to tell their stories. And I knew a lot of them when I was in Chicago, and then when I moved to New York too, I met a lot of them who were telling me the frustrations of having able-bodied people be cast in roles that they felt that they weren't given a chance to portray, even though it's their experience. So yeah, we have a Greg Mascala has cerebral palsy and he's playing a character with CP, and then Katie Sullivan is playing a character who's quadriplegic. She is actually. She was born with, there's a very long name that I don't remember for what this condition is, but she was born without knees and lower legs, or legs. And so she's also a Paralympian. She wow. like set a world record for I think sprints. Her husband, I think, is quadriplegic. So she, was born disabled and is like part of that community, but then she's able to pull from the experience with her husband specifically for being quadriplegic.
And when you found these folks, had they had mm-hmm. much experience with this sort of play, a play written for, mm-hmm. certain aspects of their real experience? Or
they had a lot of them were making their own work because it wasn't available to them. There weren't enough roles to sustain a career in that way for the theater, I think, or people just weren't going to them. I mean, you know, there was the controversy with that movie, is it Me Before You, that had it cast an able-bodied man in the role of I think he's also quadriplegic in that film. And their rationale was, well, there's one scene where he's walking, where we right. see him in the past, and right. so therefore they needed him. And it's like, well, it's not really, it was an economic thing. I mean, it was like, let's get a star to, right. you know, play this role. And like talking to to Greg and Katie, they, you know, they joke that, like, well, he's going to get an award if he plays somebody who's disabled. Like, this is just, you know, it's seen as like this transformative thing to play somebody with a disability, but it actually is, you know, it's pretty offensive to not even consider going into that community where they, the artists exist and have been shut out from a certain level of, just a certain level. Like, they'll make more money for me before you than they will doing a small show off Broadway that they've written that, you know, maybe five people will see.
Right, exactly. So it isn't. In many ways, it's questionable to go that route, but nothing new, right? Folks in certain minority communities are often portrayed by people who aren't from those communities, whether it be gays and LGBTQ folks, and the list goes on and on and on. But your show, you're being sensitive to that because you believe it's important. It's an ethical decision, I presume. And plus, these folks are very talented. Despite all the reasons why you would choose them anyway.
They're great. They're great. Yeah.
Now, when you're there working on this production, you kind of alluded to this earlier. Mm-hmm. It's been some time since you initially wrote it, and now you have some perspective that you didn't have back then. Tell us about any unforeseen artistic developments in the production you wouldn't mind, you know, revealing.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a so the process of Williamstown was very fast. Tech lasted about 20 hours, and usually it's a week long process. That's the sort of nature of that, of how time works at Williamstown. And we had two previews, whereas like at Manhattan Theater Club we'll have 2.5, 3, which is kind of more standard. So a lot of things that I saw once all the moving parts came together, the set and lights and everything like that, and then we put the last part, and the most important part is the audience and their responses. I didn't get a chance to really address the things I would have liked to put in because we didn't have much time to put them in before it was official opening, and they had to go for, they started their run. And so certain things that changed in this one, like the story is still the same. I've been trying to clarify certain things that I think were confusing or not as clear, like what specifically with the disabilities, what they entail, like people. So Katie, because she was born without legs, and the audience sees her in a wheelchair, and so they just think she's an amputee, as opposed to thinking that understand that she's quadriplegic and has no movement in her arms or her legs and anything below the neck. And so I've been putting in here and there, like letting the audience know exactly what she's dealing with. Similarly for Greg's character. So that's one kind of basic thing that I've put in. And a larger one is we're clarifying time too, because it plays with time. And then the big note I got throughout was, which is interesting because it's just the thing that the play emerged from this specific experience, and yet it's the one that felt least clear to an audience, which was, how is somebody who is college educated and able-bodied in America, how do they, this is kind of a spoiler, but how do they end up homeless and living in a car? That just felt, the people had such a hard time swallowing that is a reality for a lot of people. And so I had to kind of put in little, you know, small things, small steps to get to clue an audience into how that can incrementally happen, how you can get to such a state of economic despair when you're educated and able-bodied and living in America. So that was a big one.
Yeah. And this was something that you added in after the initial run. To a certain extent.
No, it was in there. It's just that I think people sort of came out of nowhere, which I thought, which I didn't have a problem with because I felt like that is what sort of happens. It's like there's one or two things happen to you, and then you were like, oh, here I am. This is the position that I'm in. But that didn't. That isn't the experience of a lot of the people that come to the theater.
So
I was like, yeah.
So how'd you?
So I just kind of.
No, go ahead. I think you're going there.
Oh, sorry. Oh yeah, yeah. So how did I put that in? I put in little clues about we don't see what's going. All the scenes happen with the two people, kind of these two Hander scenes with one couple and the other couple, and so we don't see what their lives are like when they're not together. And so I was just bringing in certain language for that character to say when she would come in and go into work, that indicated that there were things going on. There were certain things that were going on that she just chose not to share, but that there was something. And so it kind of just tips the audience off to be mindful and watch that there's something going on that she's just not willing to share, and that we'll probably find out about it later. So it didn't come as much of a shock, because I've had, until then, I had her playing as though everything is fine. I think she was playing too convincingly that everything's fine. So there's a few cracks. There's a few more cracks on the road to the reveal.
A little foreshadowing, more so for people. Mm-hmm, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, how about your work? I'm thinking about your description. I'm enjoying it. How about your work being translated into another medium, you know, into TV and film? Is that happening? Do you hope that'll happen?
Yeah, I'm actually trying to. I'm actually trying to make Cost of Living into a film. I'm working on that right now. I figured that was while my head is in the space of this play to work on the film version, which is actually that one's fun and easy, because it lets me get into the aspect of close-ups is great. I mean, particularly with two people on stage, like I get to look closer into what that experience is, particularly with caregiving bodies and things like that for this play. I was at a talkback with Denzel Washington was doing a talkback of Fences when he filmed the movie, and he was saying that one of the best things for him was actually getting to show Pittsburgh, because it was for, you know, we've all seen August Wilson plays, but not all of us have been to Pittsburgh, and so it was just so great to actually see it in the film. These things that we don't, you know, the feeling mm-hmm. of Pittsburgh is brought into those plays, but we don't get to see mm-hmm. it. And so that's something similar too, is being able to see what the environment of like that part of New Jersey is. For TV, I have a play called Queens that's going to be going up next year, also in New York. And I'm trying to make that into a series because it's that show is right now, it's 3 hours long, and I could keep going. so TV's like, we love this. Please keep going. Give us more episodes. And so I'm working on that. Some less so because of just being in rehearsals, but that's on the back burner.
So you have a station that wants to air it. You have actors and directors and such, writers.
It's so much slower for TV. This is just that one is like there's networks that are interested, and then we would form a pitch and all this sort of stuff. So it's right. like so it's really really nascent, and I haven't finished. The pitch and all that sort of stuff. So,
how about the film?
But that's on there. Yeah. Oh, but the film. Yeah, that's also new. You know, I've never worked in. I've did a little bit of TV, but I haven't worked in film, and so it's like learning a new language. Like, how does this work? I know how this works for plays. I know what the process is for plays, and so I'm kind of, yeah, I'm like a baby steps into all the world. So now I'm just going to write it and see sort of what happens.
And do you think your connections and your reputation from theater will help you get a couple doors open and get some attention, at least, to hear your pitch?
Oh, I hope so. I mean, I hope so. It's actually kind of easier to get into the door than I thought. once you've had a play in New York, I think that people are... I've been told that people are looking for playwrights, specifically for TV. I've worked on some TV and been offered certain other ones that I couldn't do because of scheduling, and they're looking for playwrights in the world of TV.
Excellent. Good. Good luck with that. And
Thank you.
I want to ask you a couple of more questions. Again, folks, we're talking to Martina Majok, and she is one of the premier playwrights in our nation, talking to her in New York City. where she is working on a production of Cost of Living. It'll be previewing starting May 16th, and then opening night is June 7th at the Manhattan Theater Club, right off Broadway. Now, why should people come to see this production, Cost of Living? I mean, there are some heavy issues going on here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's heavy issues, but I don't, I'm in the business of subverting, I think, where expectations of those kinds of stories are supposed to be. So for example, there's a major trope about disabled narratives. There's two like kinds of disabled stories that are kind of popular. One is the like inspirational, I can do anything story. What is the name of the Stephen Hawking movie? Against All Odds story.
Yes,
which is true, but it's definitely it can get kind of syrupy and sentimental everybody into like just overly noble saints. And then the other one is the dying with dignity narrative, which is being disabled is oh so terribly horrible. How could you possibly live in a disabled body? The only option must be to kill yourself, which is, that happens, absolutely. And like, people make their choices about what they want to do with their lives. But I know so many people in life for whom that is not true, that are living full lives within disabled bodies and who would never think to do that. That's just not how they see the world. And so I'm trying to bring in other narratives that haven't been that are lacking, and so that I knew from the get like that would not be in there. Nobody was going to commit suicide, there were going to be characters who feel uncomfortable around disability, where we'd poke fun at that, and there's a lot of jokes, there's a lot of humor, because I just feel like that is the honest experience of that. I was talking to Greg, who's the actor who has cerebral palsy, and he feels like he has to be the first person to crack a joke. He's always telling me he has to be the first person to crack a joke because people don't know how to talk to him when they first meet him, and so he has to be the one that makes him comfortable. And so I put that into the narrative too. So I'm hoping it's something that is a surprising story. It's something that people don't expect to see on stage when you hear that this is a play about people with disabilities. And I hope it's going to be fun and funny. And I think there's some beautiful moments that we're staging, and there's people get called out, and it's trying to make it as honest as possible and funny. So, yeah. I hope they come.
That was great. It sounds like a great show to go. And I mean, we have to be, let's just be logical. If it's at the Manhattan Theater Club, they're not opening their doors to you because you're a charming person. It's because the production has some substance. It's a good piece. That's why it's at this theater. So, right there. It speaks volumes. Congratulations, break a leg.
Thank you.
And this is a strange question, perhaps, for you. And I'm coming at you without you. You have no clue that I'm going to ask you this, and maybe you won't want to answer it. But you might. I think you might. I like building it up here. Here's my chance at drama.
now, my social security number is.
Here's the question, Martina. How would you respond if Vice President Mike Pence came to a production of Cost of Living?
Wow. Wow. Man, I feel like what Hamilton did was the best they could have done, to be honest. Like I saw some people who were so against what that was, because they, felt similarly to Mr. Twitter, who said that, to President Twitter, who said that, they should be ashamed of themselves, that a theater is a safe space or whatever. I'm like, I strongly disagree. We're having a conversation, and the best way for us to have a conversation is for me to actually show you people living through an experience. I could have written you an email, truly, but it wouldn't have been as effective as if you were watching bodies on stage telling you their experience. So I think I probably would have just like taken a page from the book of Hamilton and done the same thing, or like asked him to come and get a drink with me and all of us, you know, and see what that is. I think so. Number one way of disarming people is like humor in the theater, and number two is the bar. So hopefully a combination of both.
Excellent. Good answer.
And I've got the next play is about LGBTQ issues too, so I can be like, I just throw in that one too.
Oh, your next play is focusing on those issues?
The next one after Queens, yeah, it's a play called Sanctuary City. That one is taken from life too. It's when I almost when I became naturalized, because I'm an immigrant to the country. When I became naturalized, I had a lot of friends. Who were immigrants like me, and one of my closest friends was undocumented, and he was not able to apply to go to college because he wouldn't have gotten financial aid. And so it's the story of when we almost got married for citizenship. He's also gay, and was not so at that time, 2004, he was not able to get married in order to as a route towards citizenship. He was very young too, so he was a dreamer. So he basically was, I think he was here in the country at that point for over half his life. This was when we were 18. And so we almost got married so that he could stay in the country and go to college, and become a citizen. And it's sort of the breakup of our friendship because of that process, going through that.
Wow. So that's going to inspire the Sanctuary City work is a bit that experience.
I wrote that play in 3 days.
Great.
Like last month, and so that's the new one that I have to look at, but that's what that is. Yeah. So I'll be like, Mr. Pence.
Let's talk.
Let's be friends. Yes. Let's be friends, yeah.
I look forward to this production. Hopefully I can get out and see it for the preview.
And then we can go drinking.
That would be fun. That would be fun. And it seems you have a bunch of stuff in the queue I'm also looking forward to. And hopefully you'll come back on Troubadours and Rock On Tours and we could talk a bit more.
I would love it.
Well, thank you for taking time out of rehearsals. You going back this afternoon, or
back right now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm so honored to have you on the program, and it's exciting to talk to you. You're such a cool person. Thank you so much.
You're a cool person. Thank you for having me. I always love coming on here. This is great.
Beautiful. Have a wonderful Saturday.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Your heart is warm, your hands are cold. You know the truth, but the story gets old. You stood on the corner for a long time. People passing by gave you nickels and dimes. They think you're one of the nameless, 'cause you got no record and you ain't famous. Oh, Bill, I know how you're feeling. Your heart's on fire, your head is reeling. But with a spirit to guide you and a friend beside you, you know you'll win if you're only willing. The sun's so hot and my heart is thumping. Let me buy you a beer or something. You've been traveling a hard road. Sit down, Bill, and lighten your load. If you need a friend, give me a call. I got your picture on my wall. From one compadre to another, I love you, Bill, as I would my brother. Oh, Bill, I know how you're feeling. Your heart's on fire and your head is reeling. But with the spirit to guide you and a friend beside you, you know you'll win if you're only willing. Oh, Bill, I know how you're feeling. Your heart's on fire and your head is reeling. But with the spirit to guide you and a friend beside you, you know you'll win if you're only willing.
The University of the Night. My Aunt Teresa worked for years on an assembly line at a correspondence school. She didn't sit in a machine, sewing hats or dresses or undergarments, like other factory ladies in our town. She didn't sling hash at a diner or a cafeteria, like my Aunt Jewel. She didn't man a counter at a downtown department store, like my mother. She boxed booklets that were mailed to eager students all over the country, all over the world, who scratched away at the American dream on kitchen tables, basement workbenches, and tiny bedroom desks. Our town is the birthplace of the correspondence school, but the founder wasn't a native. He was a newspaper man who came from another coal town with the deceptively romantic-sounding name of Shenandoah. Originally, in the late 19th century, he used his method to teach mine safety. He soon expanded his curriculum to not just save miners' lives and limbs, but to help them move up, as foremen say, and then out of the mines altogether, to jobs that wouldn't blacken their lungs and send them to an early grave. Picture these first students, home from the mine at night, attempting to study, surrounded by long-suffering wives and four or five noisy children. The only thing the miner wanted was a drink, but he had to puzzle over math or grammar. The founder's ideas caught on, and he and his successors created the World Schoolhouse, as they branded themselves. Not just for miners, but students everywhere, or the blue-collar students who weren't successful in traditional classrooms and who wanted to be their own teachers, with occasional support from the starchy and stalwart faculty at the school headquarters. On their own, they could learn almost every subject under the sun, drafting and railroad car maintenance, and radio, TV, VCR, and computer repair, the courses changing with the times. You learn by reading. How basic. You go to the mailbox, and there are your textbooks. You read. You mail in your exams. You graduate. You're on your way to a new career, a new life, a new you. As the school flourished, the founder expanded his offerings, and, an architecture aficionado, he built handsome structures around town, some of which still stand. The original school headquarters, an unlikely Gothic building on a downtown thoroughfare, now houses senior citizens long past caring about careers. The imposing structure that once served as the school's domestic institute, created in the 1930s to teach ladies, young and old, the homemaking arts, is now a Jesuit prep school. Across the street, where the printing plant once cranked out thousands of textbooks, golden boys and girls from the school play soccer. Our correspondence school has its famous, and now mostly forgotten, alumni. Arthur Godfrey, for example. You'd have to be fairly old, perhaps sitting in a chair in that Gothic former schoolhouse, gazing at the past through rheumy eyes, to know Arthur Godfrey, a ukulele-strumming radio and TV personality who hosted a talent show, the American Idol of the mid-20th century. A seemingly benign and folksy fellow with a dictatorial streak, he was a big name in his day and promoted the careers of equally forgotten entertainers, like Julius LaRosa, a crooner Godfrey famously fired on air and whose career subsequently floundered for years. Walter Chrysler, founder of the car company, was also a graduate, as well as Eddie Rickenbacker, World War I flying ace. My favorite student is even more obscure. In one of his New Yorker profiles, Joseph Mitchell interviewed Lady Olga, a bearded lady who eked out a living in a sideshow. She dreamt of leaving her seedy side of show business, and so she studied stenography with an old correspondence course she bought in a second-hand bookstore in Chicago. There she sits, stroking her beard, poring over her booklets, dreaming of becoming a stenographer, Mitchell says, the way some women dream of Hollywood. More famous than the alumni were the ads. In the backs of magazines, the pulps, like Men and True and Adventure, the ladies' mags, like Good Housekeeping and McCall's and Ladies' Home Journal, the hobbyist mags, the comics. Wherever there were readers, there were potential students. You picked your subject off the current list of courses, mailed in your coupon, and you were on your way to fulfilling your aspirations. To respect, money, a happy life. There were the matchbooks with ads, back in the day when everyone smoked, so everyone needed matchbooks. You reached for a Pall Mall, closed the cover before striking, and imagined yourself a motorcycle repairman. Then there were the ubiquitous and much-mocked television commercials, which lured unemployed insomniacs late at night or unlucky layabouts watching soap operas or game shows during the day. The magazine ad, cited as a classic by professional persuaders, was titled The University of the Night. In it, young Abraham Lincoln is depicted lying down, reading a book. Here's one of our country's most revered autodidacts. Honest Abe, and you. If you apply yourself, you could become, if not president, then perhaps a dental technician. Pick up that booklet, carefully packaged by my Aunt Teresa, and read.
I've been loving you a long time. Down all the years, down all the days. And I've cried for all your troubles. Smile at your funny little ways. We watched our friends grow up together, and we saw them as they fell. Some of them fell into heaven, some of them fell into hell. I took shelter from a shower, and I stepped into your arms on a rainy night in Soho. The wind was whistling all its charm. I sang you all my sorrows. All your joys. Whatever happened to that old song? To all those little girls and boys. In the morning, the ginger lady by my bed, covered in a cloak of silence, I'd hear you talking in my head. I'm not singing for the future. I'm not dreaming of the past. I'm not talking of the first times. I never think about the last. Now the song is nearly over. We may never find out what it means. Still, there's a lot I hold before me. You're the measure of my dreams, the measure of my dreams.
Beloved, from sweet September moon to the prospect of a nap under the spruce late morning in early June, as the days expand and expire, as we are apt to see, the beloved traverse our custom designed inconsistency, just so we might feel alive and in control as we strive back from the nap into the thick of things.
She was a level-headed dancer on the road to alcohol, and I was just a soldier on the way to Montreal. Well, she pressed her chest against me about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, she gave me a peck on the back of the neck, and these are the words she spoke. Blow up your TV, throw away your paper, go to the country, build you a home, plant a little garden, eat a lot of peaches, try and find Jesus on your own. Well, I sat there at the table and I acted real naive, for I knew that topless lady had something up her sleeve. Well, she danced around the barroom and she did the hoochie coo. Yeah, she sang her song all night long, telling me what to do. Blow up your TV, throw away your paper, go to the country, build you a home, plant a little garden, eat a lot of peaches, try and find Jesus on your own. Well, I was young and hungry and about to leave that place. Just as I was leaving, well, she looked me in the face. I said, you must know the answer. She said, no, but I'll give it a try. And to this very day, we've been living our way. Here is the reason why. We blew up our TV, threw our paper, went to the country, built us a home, had a lot of children,
fed them on peaches. They all found Jesus on their own.
And there you have it, episode 225 of Troubadours and Rock On Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, one of our great contemporary American playwrights, Martina Mayoc. She has a show opening up on June 7th at the Manhattan Theater Club off Broadway, with premieres or previews opening up on May 16th. Check her out on the internet. M-A-J-O-K is the way to spell her last name. Thank you, Martina, for a wonderful conversation and break a leg with cost of living. We also like to thank our resident essayist, associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for crafting and reading another wonderful piece. I also like to thank these musical artists: Buddy Miller, E-Bass, Lucinda Williams, The Pogues, John Prine, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. And I also like to thank you and you and you, our listeners. Those of you in Sweden, in France, in Norway, in England, in Kenya, in Somalia, in Uganda, in San Francisco, in L.A., in New York, in Columbus, in Philadelphia, in Iowa. Amazing. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Until next week, enjoy this week. Take care.